the 10% that have TDK.
All right, welcome everyone. We'll get this committee started. This is the Transportation and Public Safety Committee, Monday, February 18th, 2013. We have four bills on the agenda today, and we will start with Senator Dahl, Senate File 174. Welcome to the committee, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee members. I think this is Senate File 174. And this is my third run at this. This is to remove a prohibition. Current law, Section 85 of the 2002 session laws, Chapter 393, placed a prohibition on the Met Council, MnDOT, and county regional rail authorities from taking any action to study, plan, engineer, design, or construct the Dan Patch commuter rail line identified in the Metro Council's 2020 Transit Master Plan as a corridor between Minneapolis and Northfield. And the language also requires that any future revision to the Council's Transportation Development Guide, the Council's Transit Master Plan, or MnDOT's Transportation Plan, or Commuter Rail Systems Plan must remove all references to this potential future rail line. Dan Patch, of course, named after the famous Pacer of Minnesota history lore. But you all have a map of where the Dan Patch commuter rail could potentially, existing rail that could potentially be a part of the Metro Council's bigger plan. And I think over the years I've learned that, by the way, we were able to pass it through the Senate a couple of times. We just think that it's bad policy to basically legislate through a gag order. And we think that the Met Council, as they are supporting this bill, that they believe that all consideration should be given to projects such as this. So I think we should I do have two testifiers. I could briefly comment. Mayor Jane Williams and Lisa Fries from SCALE. So
right. Go ahead. Welcome to the committee, Mayor.
Thank you, committee members, staff, and those in the audience today. I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today. I am Janet Williams, the mayor of the city of Savage. Our town, of course, is named after the owner of Dan Patch. But I've lived on the Dan Patch line my entire life. The railroad was built by Mr. Savage from Minneapolis to Northfield in the early 1920s. This is my third time to testify on this topic, lifting the gag order, on the Dan Patch line. And I'm here to talk about an action in 2002 that was not good public policy, and I'm here to ask that you correct it. In 1997, the Minnesota Department of Transportation did do a commuter rail system study where they listed all the possible commuter rail systems in the Twin Cities, in the metropolitan area. And right on there is the little blurb that says, and of course, since 2002, we can't talk about the Dan Patch line. This corridor in phase one identified the Dan Patch corridor as one of the six corridors for potential success. And in that commuter rail plan completed in 2002, the Dan Patch corridor was identified as a railroad or a line that could be feasible. Then in 2001, the Dakota County Regional Rail Authority approved the Dan Patch corridor commuter rail feasibility study, and that evaluated the possibility of reestablishing commuter rail service on the existing railroad tracks from Northfield to Minneapolis, and reestablishing because in the 30s it was commuter rail. The study examined potential ridership, station locations, operations, capital costs, infrastructure improvements, right-of-way, passing sidings, and the environmental screening. The study determined that 14 trains would carry 7,500 passengers each day in eight stops on this 44-mile corridor. Then in 2002, The Minnesota Legislature enacted Session Law 393, Section 85, which prohibited the Metropolitan Council, the Minnesota Department of Transportation, and any and all regional rail authorities from taking any action of study, planning, preliminary engineering, final design, or construction of the Dan Patch rail line. In addition, it rather unusually worded the prohibition further barred all and any references to the Dan Patch line, except for historical purposes. Now, since 2003, as Senator Dahl says, several attempts have been made to remove this prohibition, which is clearly excessive in its restrictive language and application, but it's been to no avail. And as the real costs of increasing traffic congestion, higher gas prices, and longer commute times continue to intensify traffic ridership levels, we're experiencing a resurgence. In fact, Scott County buses in Savage, Prior Lake, and Shakopee to downtown Minneapolis continues to see ever-increasing number of riders, despite the limited schedule and limited stops. As such, it just seems both logical and necessary that all potential transitway and transit corridor options should be allowed due consideration through an empirical, unbiased evaluation process. The current Metropolitan Council plan does not include any commuter rail or light rail service extending into Scott County and even parts of Dakota County and down to Rice County, which is where Northfield is. Two viable light rail alignments exist, including the Dan Patch line and the 169 Ferry Bridge. So the Dan Patch line crosses the southwest line that's being proposed, and there's some interest from Mankato for commuter rail on the Union Pacific from there to downtown St. Paul. That also crosses the Dan Patch line, which is a way for you to get to Minneapolis. Perfect. So the prohibition came about at a time when light rail and commuter rail were just ideas. Fast forward to today. We have a history and a record of the Hiawatha, the North Star, the Central Corridor soon to be completed, and planning for the Southwest with regard to safety, economic development, cost, use, etc. So I'm not here to ask for money. I'm here to ask that the gag order be lifted, so we can plan for transit in the region by allowing the Metropolitan Council, MnDOT, and the regional rail authorities to talk about regional transit planning. Studies done over 10 years ago had some interesting data. This little train line from Northfield to Minneapolis deserves to be recognized and not ignored or whispered about. Maybe it becomes a commuter line or abandoned, or maybe it's abandoned and becomes a trail. But at least we ought to be able to have a conversation. Thank you for your time, and I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mayor Williams. Members, any questions for the mayor? Senator Peterson.
Thanks you, Chair and Mayor Williams. I don't necessarily disagree with you, but you, myself personally, I always get nervous when we see these bills that are basically a complete repealer, and I understand why. But one concern I have is that my understanding with the repeal of this bill, it would allow the Metropolitan Council and the commissioner to go ahead and start spending money without this issue or this project coming back to the legislature. Is that correct?
Senator Dollar, Mayor Williams.
Well, Mr. Chair, I do look at the – do you have a copy of the statute? I can get you – I have a
– I don't, yeah. I just have the – is it in the bill?
Well,
it's on the back, yep.
It does in Subdivision 2, Section 85, does say the Metropolitan Council must not take any action or spend any money for study planning, preliminary engineering, final design, or construction of the Dan Patch commuter rail line. So it does have that one sentence, but again, when we're considering regional planning, the fact that you just have to ignore a pretty large chunk of many, many counties south and southwest of Minnesota. So, you know, it's not like we're going to be out there with pick shovels you know, building the a train from Northfield to Minneapolis, I think the planning is regionally, and it would include, you know, the Dan Patch in its discussion and planning.
Or just to talk,
Mayor Williams,
to be able, excuse me, to talk about it on a regional basis, because right now that can't happen.
Mr. Chair,
We'll mention that a quorum is now present. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I mean, I would like to offer an amendment, the A1 amendment, and what this amendment would do, it wouldn't prevent you from talking as you're asking right now, but it would prevent the Metropolitan Council and the Commissioner from expending any money on preliminary engineering, final design, and that type of thing without this project coming back to the legislature first. And I think this is reasonable because it would prevent this current legislature in terms of committing subsidies to a line that may or may not be in the right priority for what the legislature may or may not think that it should be at the time. And so rather than commit future legislators to subsidies by fully implementing this repeal, I would offer the A1 amendment that would ask that to come back before it moves forward.
So Senator Peterson offers the A1 amendment.
Mr. Chair, could I have Ms. Fries address that?
Yes, Senator Dahl. So I'll give everyone an opportunity to read and absorb the A1 amendment. Ms. Fries, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Lisa Fries. I'm the Scott County Transportation Program Director, and I'm here today representing SCALE, which is the Scott County Association for Leadership and Efficiency. SCALE has a part of its legislative initiatives to work towards the repeal of this particular provision. Mayor Williams addressed many of the comments I was going to hit upon, but I would like to make a couple of comments to add some regional planning perspective to this. As it stands today, this corridor cannot be looked at from a planning level, and compared to other corridors in alternatives analysis as a result of this particular provision. As well, corridors like the Southwest LRT can't even consider potential connections to this corridor. And as a result of it, we're losing some opportunity for not being able to look at this from a system-wide perspective. I understand the concern about moving forward with additional study, but the way that the current initiatives would occur, local levels of government would first do the study before it would move on to any expenditures being done by the region or the state. But what does concern me by this type of prohibition is that there are no other corridors in the entire metro area that have this type of restriction. If the corridor has merit to move into the next step, it should be able to be done without having to come back to the legislature for approval for that particular provision. Otherwise, there would be a lot of reticence, I think, on the part of the agency studying that corridor to give it consideration without it totally being lifted. So I think that it would be best if you would consider just repealing this legislation in its entirety and allow it to be considered just like any other corridor in the metro area for transit, and have it rise or fall on the merits of whether or not it's able to meet the requirements for those levels of expenditure to move to the next level of study.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Dahl.
I do believe the A1 is too restrictive, and again, I believe that any future projects would eventually come before this this committee in terms of funding and how specific it might be. So I think you would certainly have an opportunity to weigh in the future if there's any, if you feel overspending, including the Dan Patch regional line.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I would just draw your attention to the amendment, the A1 amendment. If you see on line 1.9, for example, and 1.15, all it is doing is eliminating much of what Senator Dahl is asking for. It's removing the study and planning requirement. It's also removing the references to the name, everything that they're asking for. All this amendment does is ask before the Metropolitan Council or the commissioners spend any dollars on this, that it come back to the legislature to make sure that we agree with the priority and in the order that the money is being spent. In fact, this is, I was told this is the exact same language back in 2008. It passed as Senate File 2990. And you've heard reference, to some of those past concerns, and this is an amendment that passed essentially in the same matter, and I would encourage your support. And Senator or Chair Dibble, I'd ask for a roll call vote on this amendment.
A roll call has been requested. A roll call will be granted. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question. I'm trying to understand this completely. Are there other commuter rail lines or other projects that are out there that have prohibition language for the Met Council to do anything?
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair, not that I'm aware of. No.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Jensen.
So can you explain to me why we have this language for this particular project?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl.
I believe Representative Earhart, who coincidentally now chairs the Transportation Committee in the House. We have some challenges on the other side, but we're optimistic. But he lived in this district, and I believe they just did not want a commuter rail going through their backyard. And so that was it. And since then I've talked with several of the representatives and senators. I think most people have softened on the issue. I can't speak for all of them. Some that have no longer serve here, but I think ultimately this is just bad legislation. This is about taking a piece of possibilities in terms of the state and its long-term planning in terms of commuter rail and just omitting them as for any consideration. So I just think I usually get at least that agreement from legislators who have been opposed in the past that it's really not the right way to legislate. So you'd probably have to pick the brain of Representative Earhart a little bit further, but that's what was in place, and that's what's still in place.
Senator Jensen.
Just one follow-up question. Do you feel that there are other things in place right now at Met Council for all the other projects that they look at, that this would be looked at in that same way? It wouldn't be given any different treatment than every other project? Maybe you can't answer that.
Mr. Chair, I think you probably answered your own question.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. I see Mr. Olson is looking to come to the table.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, Todd Olson with Metro Cities, represent cities in the 7-county metropolitan area. We have typically don't take positions on individual projects, but this one rises to policy for our organization just based on the policy of the prohibition. And we have a very simple two-line policy that says, in the interest of including all potential options in the pursuit of a regionally balanced transit system, Metro City supports the repeal of the law passed in 2002, which imposed a gag order on the Dan Patch commuter rail line. I think the amendment would still kind of place special status on the Dan Patch, where they would had the Met Council would have to come here before doing preliminary
study and planning.
They could do study and planning, but they'd have to come before entering preliminary engineering, and I think that would still wouldn't quite meet our policy of repealing the gag order, because it would be difficult to get the project started without special legislation, which would still be required.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any questions for Mr. Olson? Anything further on the A1 amendment, members? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there anyone that is in the audience or here to testify in opposition to this bill?
we deal with that now, Senator Carlson, or we're on the A1 amendment?
No, I'm sorry. We're dealing with the amendment in support of the A1 amendment. Modify that.
All right. Doesn't look like it. All right. So we have the A1 amendment before us. Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Chairman Dibble?
No.
Senator Carlson?
No.
Senator Champion?
No.
Senator Franzen? Senator Jensen?
No.
Senator Kent?
No.
Senator Kiffmeyer?
Aye.
Senator Miller?
Yes.
Senator Osmek?
Aye.
Senator Peterson?
Yes.
Senator Pratt? Senator Reiner?
No.
Senator Rest? Senator Senjum?
Yes.
Senator Tomasoni?
No.
Senator Westrom?
Yes.
Senator Wieger?
No.
There being 6 ayes and 8 noes, the amendment is not adopted. Back to the bill. Anything further, members?
Mr. Chair, I'd request a roll call vote on this as well.
Right, a roll call vote has been requested. A roll call vote will be granted. So on, anything further, members?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dahl?
Mr. Chair, I just want you to know that Senator Pratt is a author, and in the past this has not been a bipartisan, there's not been a partisan issue. Matter of fact, former Senator Roebling, who's in the audience, was a supporter of the language. She's now working with SCALE. But I hope that the members will consider this what it is. It's just removing a restriction on discussing and considering a possible corridor for the southern part of the Twin Cities down to Northfield and through our suburbs. So I urge your support. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to be heard on Senate File 174? All right. Senate File 174 is before us. We need someone to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, could I just have a list, maybe help me understand a little bit the difference between the bill and what we just considered in terms of amendments? I happen to like the amendment because I thought it lifted the gag order. Does the bill also lift the gag order, so to speak? And that's probably not the right way to phrase that, but does the bill do essentially the same thing, Mr. Dahl?
Senator Sundrum, the answer to your question is yes. The gag order would be lifted if the bill were to pass.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
To that point, I think the bill, and you can disagree with me if you'd like, but the bill also gives permission to the commissioner and the Metropolitan Council to go ahead and start spending money on this project without coming back to the legislature. Again, that's the clear difference in the amendment, is that the amendment lifted the gag order but asked those two entities to come back to the legislature before they started doing the spending money on the planning and final planning and preliminary engineering, final design, those types of things that are major expenditures, quite frankly, for transit projects.
Senator Peterson, I do disagree with you because this simply treats the Dan Patch as it would any other line, and we don't do major expenditures on any other lines before the legislature and the local units of government become involved. Mr. Schreiber maybe can help us. He is been very, very much involved in some of these transit lines from the time they were a distant bell, a tinkle of an idea, to, you know, full-fledged project, and he can help us understand,
Chairman,
a little better.
Bill Schreiber, representing the county's Transit Improvement Board. Just, there appears to be some difference of his opinion here as to how these projects move ahead. So if I might try to help that out. From both the Metropolitan Council standpoint as well as the MnDOT standpoint, they do what is called the 30,000-foot view of the transportation system. And oftentimes they hire outside consultants to assist in going through all of that data, looking at changing population, changing demographics, and so on, and try to identify the most worthy projects into the future that may not have been constructed at this point. They don't do preliminary engineering. They, meaning either MnDOT. MnDOT doesn't have any money. They have a dedicated fund for highways. They don't have resources for railroads. So whenever they want to do something with the railroads, they come to the legislature and either ask for an appropriation or bonding authority. As it relates to the Metropolitan Council, ultimately they build out the transitway corridors, but the planning is done at the local level. So probably the most important part of this section is Section 4 that relates to the Regional Rail Authority. And under current arrangement, the Scott County Regional Rail Authority, in conjunction with the Hennepin County and Dakota County Regional Rail Authorities, can't even do a study or an analysis or move into preliminary engineering, which they typically do with local dollars. It's not state dollars going into that or Metropolitan Council dollars. It's local dollars. And they make the determination or bring it up to a level whether it's worth pursuing as a project or not. Dakota County had already done that as it related to the Dan Patch line and said, no, as of the time of the study, this is way too expensive and we can't justify it. So it was put on the shelf and nothing more was done with it. So I think the restriction here that without bill that is placed on the regional rail authorities is the most significant part. MnDOT and Metro Council, they really aren't going to do preliminary engineering.
Thank you.
Senator Peterson.
So Chair Dibble and to the testifiers, whoever would like to answer it, from my perspective, I mean, I'm certainly in support of lifting the ban that you're describing. What I was trying to avoid is this legislature telling future legislators, making a commitment for future public subsidies. Is that what's happening with this bill as it's written right now?
Senator Dahl, Mr. Schreiber,
Mr. Olson. Chairman, in my judgment, this does not commit in any way, shape, or form any future subsidies.
Thank you.
What it does do is lift the ability to either look at it from the 30,000-foot level or look at it on the part of the regional rail authorities at a closer local level.
Thank you. Anything further, members, on Senate File 174? Didn't see anyone come forward to testify on the bill. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl, are people in your community, district, really clamoring for this, or is this some group that brought this legislation to you? And I ask that in the context of I remember when this legislation was passed several years ago. I think it was former Representative Segrin and maybe Lincheski at the time. And I remember it being a bipartisan concern that people in these areas didn't want to have to worry about this. So are you hearing this from your district or more from industry planners that are looking at more commuter rails, or where's the drive coming from to lift this ban?
Well, Senator Westrom, I think you arrived a little late. We had the mayor of the city of Savage testify. We had the transportation manager of Scott County, who's representing a coalition of folks, okay, also testified, speak to the community leadership and community desire to at least be able to take a look at the Dan Patch. I don't think there are industry folks who sell commuter rail who are driving this. But Senator Dahl, if you would like to respond.
Mr. Chair, I think you're right. It's one of the legislative priorities of SCALE, the Scott County Alliance for Leadership, and something. And And my Northfield community is really, really, as you can imagine, with two private colleges and most of the students there from all over the nation that don't have automobiles and are trying to find transportation to the cities, it's a really a high priority. We're talking about redoing and removing, renovating an old depot, and they see this vision of possibly a commuter rail to Minneapolis someday. So there may be communities in Edina or others that may be opposed, but the people that I'm working with, the people that I represent, feel that this would be a good piece of legislation to at least start the discussion again. We're not building a train tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks.
Thank you. Senator Osmick.
Mr. Chair, Senator Dahl. I guess my position on this is that we're opening a Pandora's box we don't need to open. I guess I'd like to ask you a few questions about the existing commuter rail line. What do you know about the current costs as far as current average costs that a rider pays and the current operating subsidy that North Star currently has? Because that's probably the most applicable, comparable type of scenario. I'm curious if you've got any information on that and how much it actually costs the state for us to operate these things.
Senator Osmick, this simply allows us to take a look at the Dan Patch. We're not going to litigate whether or not commuter rail is desirable. We're simply going to allow the professionals in conjunction with the community leaders and this legislature to be able to take a look at those questions for the Dan Patch.
Well, with all due respect, Mr. Chair, the problem is once you start the train down the tracks, it tends not to slow down, and that's where I believe that it's relevant to ask the question, if we're talking about this, what does our current lines look like and what our costs are? Because
Senator Osmick, that's simply not the case. There are a number of lines that have been studied in the metropolitan area that have been determined not to be cost-effective or feasible. So, but continue on if you'd like. I don't think you're going to get the answers that you're looking for today.
Fair enough. I'll respect the opinion of the chair.
Right, Mr. Tennyson, I saw you.
Good.
All right.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Robert Tennyson. I'm attorney in Minneapolis. I represent the I-35W Solutions Alliance. I have for over 20 years. The Solutions Alliance is a joint powers board of Hanlon, Scott, and Dakota counties, plus the cities from Minneapolis out to Elk and Newmarket. And we were involved years ago with the study of this when the legislature directed that a study of all the potential lines be made. And there was an economic study at that time, and it did have good rider potential, but there's also major construction costs with that. But this whole ban came about simply because some people didn't like it, the potential of this even in their neighborhood. It had nothing to do with the merits of it. It just was practically a local opposition to it. And we've always supported the lifting of the ban. And my members include some of the communities. Some feel a little more strongly about it than others, but it's not a. There's no way to go forward on this project without legislative authority in the long run. There'd just be so much money involved and so many other factors that I think that's not a concern at this time.
Thank you. And I'll just note for the record that we did receive by email an indication of support from the Metropolitan Council, not endorsing the Dan Patch Corridor, but endorsing the ability to do regional planning. To your point, exactly, but, you know, we're not going to get into preliminary engineering or any of those other expenditures, until we're much, much further down the road, determining whether or not this is a good idea. Senator Peterson.
Yep. Mr. Chair, I just withdraw the roll call request.
Right. Thank you. All right, members, anything further? Anyone else would like to testify? All right, who's going to move Senate File 174 for us? Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 174.
And refer to the floor?
To refer directly to the floor?
Yes, yes, Senator Carlson.
And right. Refer to the floor.
All right.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Thompson.
Did it just become a consent calendar or no?
So is that a no?
We need a vehicle, Senator Thompson. Okay. So all in favor of Senate File 174, recommend nature pass and refer to the floor of the Senate. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed no?
No.
Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Chair and Committee.
Excellent discussion, Committee. Thank you. Okay. right. Senator Carlson, if it's all right. So I think Senator Carlson. I think we might take Senator Benson, if that's all right with Senator Benson. She's here, so. And Senator Rest is presenting another committee. If that's all right, Senator Carlson. All right. Thank you, Senator Benson. Members, we're jumping to number four on the agenda, Senate File 344. We're going to hear a little bit about the Capitol Complex Area Security report that was developed during the interim under Senator Benson's leadership. Thank you for that. And then a legislative proposal that's resulted from that. Welcome to the committee, Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, for the unexpected accommodation to my calendar. I'll kind of present the report and the bill in tandem, and we can address questions to whichever suits the committee. Public safety is one of our constitutional responsibilities. And if you look at the mission statement in our report, it's Appendix A, so flip to the back and flip in a couple of pages. You'll see the first responsibility viewed by this committee is that the public be safe, but that we have an open and welcoming Capitol Area Complex. I believe included in your packets was a map of what the Capitol Complex looks like. It's quite a large area. It includes all the buildings in this space, exclusive of the Armory. So it is a good-sized geographic area. And right now, no single person is accountable for it. We need a functional, accountable security system. Our security process. We want to make reasonable efforts to protect everyone who comes to this area, school groups visiting the Capitol, an ambassador who would visit the Department of Agriculture, our staff, the state employees, even elected officials, lobbyists, and members of the media who might not always be on our A-list. But we are going to do our best to take care of everyone who comes here. If we look at the report, this report got elevated from the governor's attention after the Gabby Giffords shooting. There was an ad hoc committee that met, made some recommendations, and the first thing we noticed is we need a single point of accountability. We need resources. So responsibility and accountability are two keys to security. This committee, the advisory committee, was established so that we could work across different functions of government and across party lines to find an amenable solution. The group that was brought together was broad but focused. Lieutenant Governor Pretner Solon, Justice Paul Anderson, Senator Rest, who's not here today, myself, Representative Woodard, and Representative Paymar, along with a plethora of talented advisors, including Mark Dinansky, who is here to testify today, Major Meyerson, who is here to testify today, Chris Guven, and I apologize for the mispronunciation, the Director of Administration, who is here to testify today, as well as our Sergeants-at-Arms, Mr. Lindquist, who has joined us, members of the CAP Board, the Historical Society, the University of Minnesota Police Department, as they have to deal with a lot of geography, a lot of public security, the U of M, a second representative from the U of M Police Department, and a representative from Target Corporation, so that we could look at some best practices as are currently going forward. As we proceed, page four gives the best summary of the recommendations. The Commissioner of Public Safety is the final authority regarding public safety in the Capitol Complex area. We should establish an advisory committee that would listen to stakeholders, give feedback to the commissioner, and help the legislature understand what the needs were for security. Then the legislature would have responsibility in providing the resources in terms of personnel, equipment, and infrastructure. The Capitol Security Section would evaluate and consolidate what are right now disparate but functional security plans, bring them together for a comprehensive view of security in the hopes that we gain better security and efficiency in the use of the taxpayer dollars. And then there would be an iterative process Once we get this rolling, there would be a report coming back to the legislature so that there is a constant review of what the security needs are based on changing conditions, dollars available, and the people coming and going through the capital area. So that's a very high-level summary of what was, in 8 meetings, a pretty efficient process. And out of that work came the bill you see before you today. If I may move on to the bill, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely. And members, this is the policy committee, so we'll hear the policy provisions, of course. It'll touch on some things that are going to cost money. This bill will move from here to state and local government. It'll be referred then back to finance, and it'll visit us again for the money parts. So okay. We'll see this again to pay for these good ideas.
And as we've broached the money subject, you'll see a blank appropriation, which makes people nervous. Part of the reason for that is through the governor's budget process, we haven't pinned down exactly what the dollars are, but there is a placeholder in the governor's budget for this committee, and the department is working on what exactly the funding would look like, and we'll have that by the time you see it again. This bill, we consider it very timely. The light rail will be complete. We'll have an increase in foot traffic. The Capitol is going to be undergoing restoration. And as we repurpose part of this building and look at uses for other buildings, it's important that we consider security. And so security will be part of the Capitol restoration process. And even as light rail was built and the tunnel was redone, we took the opportunity to look at the security needs for our staff, keeping trucks away from the Capitol so that somebody couldn't get close enough to do us harm. Now they hand truck goods through the tunnel to get them to the cafeteria and get them into this building. And so small changes like that are built because you have a continual awareness of the need to improve security. As I said before, currently security dollars are spent disparately at each facility. The facilities determine their needs, but again, we don't have a comprehensive view and therefore don't have the most efficient, effective method for providing security. So we're going to develop through this bill a manager at the Department of Public Safety who will be responsible for that comprehensive view. Each facility's needs will be met. Stakeholders will be brought to the table through the advisory group, resources allocated through the legislative process and moved as needed based on current situation. The report to the legislature continues that iterative improvement. Let's keep in mind, security is about planning, preparation, and training. Resources and response, as well as situational awareness, each of us can help be responsible for security through our awareness of what's going on around us. The last thing we want is lights and sirens, and so if we develop a good plan, we'll have less risk of having an event on our facility. And if I could ask the testifiers to come forward, if you're amenable, Mr. Chair.
Absolutely.
Should we start with Mr. Donansky?
Welcome, Mr. Donansky.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Sorry for this question, Senator Benson, but what's the difference between this report and the one we're going to get?
The report that will be ongoing each January 15th will be an assessment of what our current security situation is, changes to some of the functions that happen in the facilities, and recommendations to the legislature if we need additional funding, if we need changes to appropriation resources, et cetera. So that will be an annual report that is the responsibility of the Department of Public Safety and the advisory committee that we establish. And if I may, a little further, Senator Tomasoni, Capitol security has happened in fits and starts. The legislative auditor in 2009 said there had been 5 attempts to do this. And so it is the opinion of the committee, by putting a person in place that is responsible for Capitol security, requiring a report to the relevant committees of the legislature, that this will stay high enough that the work that we've done will not dissolve as it has in the past. There have been comprehensive reports. I mean, the National Guard, I think this is a redacted version, but I mean, this is a really comprehensive assessment, and our staff has done a great job with limited resources, not a comprehensive management. They keep digging away at little things to improve security, but they don't have the authority to do everything they think they need to do. And so we're trying to put accountability, responsibility, and resources in place.
And so, Mr. Chairman, just
Senator Thompson.
make sure I understand what's going on here. This appropriation would just be for personnel. It wouldn't be for capital improvements of any type that we might consider necessary as a result of some type of new security.
I believe right now it is for
Senator
personnel,
Benson.
Mr. Jedanski. He's been helping develop the financing, and so he could address that.
Mr. Jedanski, welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, Mark Jedanski, the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety. Prior to this position, I held the position with the Minnesota State Patrol as its chief for 6 years. And so over the past 8 years, I've been intimately familiar with the issues surrounding capital security and some of the challenges we've had here. In fact, as Senator Benson mentioned, since 1970, I believe there's been six comprehensive reports, including the Minnesota National Guard, the United States Secret Service, and most recently the Legislative Auditors Report. In most of those studies, there were similar themes that kept coming through. And as the Senator mentioned, those themes have been talked about. During my tenure as chief, we held a number of stakeholder meetings coming together, and I believe the Senator was also at some of those meetings where we discussed the challenges and talked about the challenges and brought forth ideas about how we could move forward, but unfortunately, it never really seemed to come to fruition. So we're very thankful that the legislature is taking a moment to step back and take a look at this once again based upon all the information that's come forward. I'd also like to point out that the question was posed specifically to resources, and certainly there are funds that are going to be attached to this. But I'd also like to point out that if you look at the report, the committee took a significant amount of time, I dare say more time, talking about policies and procedures and how to look at the complex and just how philosophically the legislature and the people that live and work here look at security on the complex. So it isn't just about resource, but rather about how we go about making the complex, and I can't remember, Senator, what we referred to, a place that people felt like they could come to and feel safe all the time. And so there are some things in there, such as the emergency manager position that the Senator spoke about, that is specifically designed to overlook from a very comprehensive view the entire complex, talking about plans, talking about exercises, and how we can move forward in doing some of those things. Another piece in here that the Senator touched on that we also think is very, very important is that of contracts. Major Meyerson will explain the contracts a little bit. About half of what we do on the Capitol complex is funded through contracts with individual agencies. And by having those contracts with individual agencies routed through Capitol Security, it kind of makes it very inflexible, to say the least. It's like having a police department, but then having every store contract with their own policemen to have them in there. And then the chief really can't pull that policeman out of the store because they're contracted to stay in that store. So the contracts are an issue that we spent a lot of time discussing and looking forward to ways to changing it. I know that, I will finish and I'll let Bob talk and we can answer some questions, I hope. In a time when it seems like on a daily basis we're seeing another shooting and we're seeing some other incident that's happening out there, there's a lot of violence. I want to speak on behalf of Commissioner Dolman and thanking you for taking the time to look at security on the complex, not only for the individuals such as yourselves that come here and work, but also, as Senator Benson mentioned, for all the visitors that come here and for all the other people that really like to come to the Capitol because it is the state's house. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jedanski. Sorry about the extra N. I guess I'm in good company. Everyone
that's
does
fine,
that.
Senator.
Major Meyerson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bob Meyerson, Major with the State Patrol, and my current assignment is as Director of Capitol Security here in the Capitol. And one thing I want to point out, just to clarify, and I believe it's in the report, the Capitol complex, it's large. It's much larger, I think, than most people realize. It's 140 acres that reaches north of Pennsylvania Avenue and south of I-94, and we have a wide variety of buildings that encompass all three branches of government. We have the Judicial Center that brings unique challenges for us, as well as the legislative branch here in the Capitol and the SOB, and then the executive branch that's throughout the building. And we currently have 10 contracts with individual entities throughout the Capitol complex. We have one, for example, with the Judicial building staff, and we have it with each one of the buildings that are represented throughout the complex, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Revenue, Human Services, so on and so forth. And they determine what they can afford and what they deem as appropriate level for officers. So it's with them that we contract, and well over half of my budget is through the contracts, and well over half the staffing with the Capitol Security officers, the civilian guards, is through contracts. And to say the least, it makes it cumbersome when we see a need where we'd like to redeploy our resources. We don't have an opportunity to do that because we're under contractual obligation with each one of these entities on the complex. The direct appropriations takes care of a very small percentage of my staffing here within the Capitol complex. So that is a piece that I'm very supportive of and anxiously looking forward to being able to better manage through direct appropriations of the staff.
Well, thank you. Questions, members? So Major Meyerson or Senator Benson, I might have missed it in your testimony. How many troopers are assigned to the Capitol complex, the 140 acres total?
Chair, we have on an ongoing basis throughout the year, there are two of us who are assigned, myself and a lieutenant. We bring in additional troopers during the legislative session, you'll notice, and that fluctuates. We have a minimum of two additional troopers that are assigned to the Capitol, and then we'll increase that as we see a need, foresee a need, or if something evolves. So at any given time throughout the year, there's a minimum of two of us. However, we have a wide range of responsibilities from the administration and management to the first line operational duties of the police officer here on the complex.
And then how many non-sworn or non-licensed personnel, security personnel, are there any?
Yes, we have, Mr. Chair, 40 civilian Capitol security officers.
Okay. So the bill would envision increasing the trooper complement to 12 and the civilian security personnel to 67 from 10 plus or 2 plus to 12 and from 40 or so to 67. Okay, great. Thanks. Then a quick question. I understand that troopers can't be transferred permanently from the Highway Patrol Division for Capitol security purposes. Do we envision what is the history of that? What's the reason and the rationale for that? There's a prohibition in law from doing that, and are we would we want to keep that in place as we're increasing dedicated security personnel, sworn or otherwise, to the Capitol?
Mr. Chair, members, just like this committee is a little awkward in that we're talking about general revenue dollars that are going here in the Transportation Committee, that follows along with how we utilize those resources as well. The state troopers that are patrolling the highways just out here on 35 and 94 are funded through those trunk highway dollars, whereas the troopers that are assigned to the Capitol complex are funded through general revenue dollars. So consequently, it would be inappropriate for us to take troopers that are being funded through trunk highway dollars and placing them into a general revenue operation.
Okay. Well, I think we need to have a little more discussion about that. A better understanding of not just the following the dollars discussion, but also the kind of the rationale. And it may make a lot of sense. It's just curious if we're going to have folks, be devoted to, the security of an area, and their professional focus is elsewhere. They're part of a highway patrol entity, and we're just detailing them on occasion over here. Given that we want to increase our level of security and professionalize it and really do better, does that continue to make sense? So I don't know if we can answer that question today, but we're coming back here, so think about that, especially as we do the money part. Anyone else have questions?
Mr.
Senator Senjum.
I'll probably just ramble for a little while and ask a couple questions in the process. And maybe Senator Tomasoni's comment, this appears to be a funding bill for and I'll maybe direct this to Senator Benson for personnel. And it seems to me the report referenced in Section 3 is about future infrastructure needs. Is that generally right? Correct?
Senator Benson.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Senjum. One of the responsibilities of the advisory committee would be to recommend security infrastructure changes at the Capitol, particularly, well, actually Capital Area Complex, but particularly as we're renovating this facility. That's really not appropriate for a building of this stature, but as the Capitol is going through its transformation, it will be very important that we are aware, as part of the architectural process, security improvements that can be made, that we're using best practices. And actually, we have an expert in administration. Go ahead and say your name for the record.
I can just get the essence of my question, because, and you know, we all come from different life experiences, but it seems to me that infrastructure, whether it be cameras or any other kind of security infrastructure provisions within the building, will dictate in the end how many people you need. It seems to me we've decided here how many people we need, and now we're going to decide what the infrastructure is. So that's the essence of my question. Are we getting ahead of the infrastructure planning? In my mind, will direct eventually what kind of people force you need. But we're already in numbers defining the people requirement, and now we're going to go back and identify what kind of infrastructure we need. That's, I don't know, I won't say it's troubling, but that's where I'm a little bit confused to what I'm used to thinking about,
right,
in terms of how this all works.
Right. Mr. Chair and
I think,
Senator
Senator Senator Tomasoni wanted to expand on that.
Yeah, and I think we're thinking kind of the same way, which kind of scares me. But thank you, Mr. Chairman. No, the issue of going from 2 to 12 and then going from 40 to 67 is interesting, because I'd like to know how that was determined, first of all. And then to Senator Senjum's question about the infrastructure, since we're doing some physical renovation of the Capitol in the very, very near future, are we going to need new security and change what we did? Is it going to be all figured out how to do the new security improvements, which might be physical infrastructure type improvements? So I haven't read this report closely, but does this report indicate that we need more physical security type things, or will the new report say that the infrastructure needs to be changed, and then how will it fit into the current plans for renovation, I guess. So I don't know if that's a lot of stuff, but I think I'm thinking the same way you are.
Yeah, I think people versus infrastructure, are they similar to Senator Benson, to our brief discussion on the floor?
Mr. Chair, my question is what comes first?
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Senjum and Tomasoni. There are two intersecting circles. One is not exclusively the first priority, and neither are a complete solution on their own. As we're going through capital renovation, it is important that we work with the architects. There are best practices in security. The Department of Administration will work, as this building is going through its transformation, to make sure we're forward-looking. We get a once every 150-year shot at changing this capital. So we don't need the most expensive security improvements to this building, but we need basic structural changes. For example, I gave the tunnel example. We could have just put things back exactly the way they were, but somebody said, you know what, it would be safer if trucks were across the street and not abutted to the building. That's a standard best practice now for corporate facilities and government facilities. And so it's that kind of infrastructure change that as we're going through the changes in this building and iteratively, the Department of Administration will be making changes going forward. Do you put large flower pots in front of buildings to prevent a truck from driving into it? And I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on those things, but that's the thoughtful process that we are expecting will happen going forward. The personnel issue, and Major Meyerson, I'm sorry, he got a promotion mid-cycle, and I still refer to him as Captain, and I apologize. Captain or Major Meyerson will explain a little bit how that was developed, but our goal is 24/7 trooper presence in the complex with the Capitol Security Forces to supplement in the buildings. And those numbers can be adjusted as a thorough needs assessment is done. And I'll let you explain a little bit further.
Major.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators, a couple of questions. I'm not sure exactly which one to address, but I heard a couple of questions about that, and I think she put it well. There's two circles here that aren't exclusive of one another, and one of the issues I think that where we have fallen short in the past in attempting to improve security as we looked at them in individual silos, and I think they need to be looked at together. But one of the pieces when we consider infrastructure, I think a lot of focus came upon that because of the renovation and the preservation process that's going on right now for this building alone. However, I'm trying to consider comprehensively what the needs are when it comes to staffing, and we have a desperate need to have an increased level of licensed police officers on the Capitol complex 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and we lack that right now. And you had spoke of something a little bit earlier that we'd get to later, but it really answers, I think, part of the question about pulling the troopers off the road and assigning them in the Capitol complex. And this is a unique environment here, and I believe so strongly that we need to have police officers that are intimately familiar with the complexities of the buildings and the structure and the environment here. There has been example after example where we've had troopers come in temporarily, or our allied agencies, whether it's the county or the city, and they're inadequately prepared to deal with the buildings and the structure and the complexity of this. And our reactionary staffing, they need to have an intimate familiarity with the Capitol and the Capitol complex, as large as it is. Did that answer the question? I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman, I think just...
Senator.
How did you determine to go from 2 to 12 and 40 to 67, or was that the answer?
Well, Major Myers.
Mr. Chair, Senator, we took a look at what it would take for us to have 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, adequate staffing, and what has been called upon and recognized that we're lacking through previous security assessments. We want to have bodies in particular, staff in particular locations, and the ability to respond and to react. So there was forethought, and some would say that it's far less than needed, and it's a foundation, I think, though, that gives us the ability to respond and to react. And there was significant forethought in why we would go from 2 to 12 troopers.
Okay. Senator Sengem.
The formula I remember is if you're going to go 24/7, one person 24/7, you need five people with vacations and everything else. So that would seem, I mean, pretty close to right. That would bring about something in the neighborhood, well, 5 into 80, 16 people essentially on a shift at any one time within the Capitol complex. Is that kind of where we are in terms of numbers? I'm not saying that's too many or too little, but is that kind of the thought?
Major Myerson.
Mr. Chair, Senator, that is approximate that I've heard. If you want 24/7, it's five, approximately five point something per FTE.
And I'll just for members, to my earlier question, this is kind of our standard appropriation language for capital security that we include in our finance bills. It says the commissioner may not spend any money from the Trunk Highway Fund for capital security, or two, permanently transfer any state trooper from the patrolling highways activity to capital security. And then it also puts a wall around transferring the general fund to highway patrol purposes and transferring trunk highway money back to capital security, just to make sure we got the point in the first place. So that's the question I have. Does that continue to make sense? Especially the second part, permanently transfer any state trooper from the patrolling highways activity to capital security. So I'm wondering if we need a new job title. If we're going to be placing people, this is going to be their profession, this is what they do. On a permanent, ongoing, year-round basis. This is something we're thinking about. Just put it out there. We don't need to settle that today. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And we have been joined by the Director of Administration, Chris Guven, and I probably mispronounced your last name.
That's fine, ma'am.
So welcome to the committee. Introduce yourself with the correct pronunciation of your name, please. And,
Mr.
Proceed.
Chair, my name is Chris Guven.
All right.
Close enough. I'm the Director of Plant Management here at the Capitol Complex, and I'm one of the advisors on the Security Committee, and wholeheartedly support the recommendations of the committee. There's been some discussion about the infrastructure upgrades or additions to the Capitol Complex and the Capitol building specifically. And, infrastructure upgrades take time and they cost a lot of money. As part of the process over the past several years, there have been several vulnerability assessments that have been done by the National Guard as well as the legislative auditor. And they listed a whole host of infrastructure upgrades that they recommended to be performed in the building, in the Capitol building itself, and the Capitol complex as well. Unfortunately, they did not attach a scope of work to that, nor did they attach cost. And that's what we need to do through the committee over the next several months, and that is what the report on the 30th of September that's due to the committee will address. I mean, we have a good roadmap of where we think we need to go, but we need to sit down and cost these things out and come up with a priority list based on consultation between the Department of Admin, the committee, and Department of Public Safety. And so that's where we're heading with that, Senator DeSengem, to kind of answer your question on the infrastructure. Those are long lead items. And down the road, they certainly will affect the manning or staffing requirements here on the Capitol complex. So those are certainly subject to change as these infrastructure upgrades, if funded, are implemented, or are implemented if funded. A couple of things, too, specifically with regards to the Capitol building that we are addressing right now through the restoration design that's underway at this point, things that really won't impact the staffing level, such as encasing all the communications conduit that's down in the basement of this building that you see every day as you walk through the tunnels. Those wires are exposed, could be cut. That doesn't necessarily impact funding. Putting additional barriers at some of the entry ports in the parking lots as well as on Aurora. So those are things that we're incorporating as part of the restoration. We have a lot of ventilation shafts that aren't secured the way that they should be so that people can't crawl through those. Those are the types of things that we're looking at implementing or incorporating into the design of the facility here. So those we're addressing now. It's fluid. We are working through. There are members on the design team with the architects, folks from our department, as well as DPS that are working through these things and trying to implement as many things as feasible and we can afford through the design as part of this project. So I don't want to ramble too much, but we are addressing the infrastructure items, and we will report to the committee, who will in turn report to you what we recommend.
I think it's built on you.
Thank you. Great. Senator Benson.
Mr. Chair, and if there are no more questions for that testifier, I'd like to introduce Mr. Sven Lindquist, who's kind of been my partner through all of this and helping me understand behind the scenes before we got to meetings how security has worked, and if you could say a few words.
Thank you, Senator
welcome
Benson.
To the committee, Mr. Lindquist.
Thank you, Senator Benson, and Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I apologize for my my voice. I've finally succumbed to the crud that most people have been dealing with these last weeks, and it's kind of a struggle. Happy to be here. I have been Chief Sergeant Arms for a number of years, as many of you all know. We took a first earnest crack at this long before the events of 9/11. Then Senator Randy Kelly, who chaired the jurisdiction of the time, and then Minority Leader Senator Dean Johnson, authorized legislation to provide two things, a Capitol Security Oversight Committee, as well as a study that was conducted by the BCA. I believe this was back in 1999. So this has been an ongoing effort for a very long time, and to kind of quote our good friend Associate Justice Paul Anderson, it has been admired for years, and it's really honestly time that something be done. Every time there's an incident like the unfortunate situation that happened in Tucson with Congressman Giffords, thankfully Governor Dayton convened a large group of people who spent a very long time addressing this. The result of that was the creation, again, the second creation of the Capital Security Oversight Committee. The first Capital Security Oversight Committee somewhat sunsetted out for lack of activity a number of years ago, and the result always has been the fact of the cost. And cost is obviously a part of this, be it in FTEs, cost in the case of technology. It's always difficult to discuss these topics in an open public setting because in some way, shape, or form, you play your hand, either what you have or what you don't have. I will go so far as to say that we have been very fortunate for a number of years providing a high degree of perception of security around here. On 9/11, we had 37 wide-open doors to this building, and those doors were rather rapidly closed down, and card readers have been put in place, and cameras have been put in place to the point that I believe there's over 500 cameras on this complex. The facts of the matter are it takes people to interact with people, and I'm certainly appreciative of your efforts, the efforts of all the people who put forth a great amount of time over this summer, Lieutenant Governor Yvonne Prettner-Solin, who did an excellent job in chairing the committee. We have truly studied this to death, and in conjunction with this opportunity for the renovation of the Capitol building and whatever other parts and pieces, other buildings may be brought to the complex as a result of this, this is our chance to do something for the good of the institution. You know, on a daily basis, it's a concern to me with the very isolated ends of this building. And with both members of the current majority and the former majority, you're all now intimately familiar with the operations of this building and how very isolated people can be in far wings on third floor in the northeast corner. At times, it's a very long way from other staff or other members, and it can be a very isolated and lonely feeling. And I thank you for your time and your interest in reviewing this legislation, and would stand for any questions.
Mr. Lindquist, you mentioned 500 cameras. Are those for the purpose of monitoring in real time what's going on? And if so, how many folks have their eyes on those cameras?
There's a dispatch center in the basement that's operated by State Capitol Security, and I believe there are two dispatchers on call or on duty and watching and clicking through those cameras. It certainly is not a real-time, minute-to-minute observation of all 500 cameras. In many cases, what we're able to do is record a crime and go back and review the happenings, and in some cases be of assistance to St. Paul Police or Ramsey County Sheriff as they reconstruct what happened on the perimeters of this complex. One thing I'll tell you, just based on the years of reviewing this complex is a very safe piece of real estate in some of St. Paul's ugliest crime neighborhoods. And as we send staff to the perimeters to park, and as members come and go, we've been very fortunate to avoid incidents. So the many, many cameras, much technology, but it takes people to monitor.
I would concur. Just today we had an incident, not an incident. This is a situational awareness story. There was a bag underneath the spiral staircase that I saw. Looked pretty sketch. There was no one around. I actually ran around a little bit to try to find someone to point it out to, but we just went up and called and got someone to take care of it. I have no idea what the deal was. But the bag was sitting there, this black bag with this orange who knows what sticking out of it. Thought, well, that's probably not the best thing in the world to have sitting around untended. So I assume someone came and took it away. Didn't see the bomb squad come, so I think we're all okay.
You saved my life.
Yes, absolutely.
You saved my life.
So if you see bags sitting around, call, get them taken away. Not a good thing. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Lindquist? Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Lindquist, you're probably going to get a question that's maybe not fair to you because maybe it more rightfully deserves Major Meyerson. But on the premise that over time we're probably going to have a lot more people die of heart attacks in this building than gunshots, do we have a crash cart? Do we have staff here that are, you know, emergency medical technicians? Are they part of our security staff at all at this point, or do we rely on downtown?
Mr. Lindquist or whomever would like to answer.
I'll take a quick lash at it, and certainly Major Meyerson can add, but I will tell you that there's a high degree of training with both the State Patrol and my staff The blue shirts are also trained to respond to those medical emergencies.
Okay.
I won't tell you that we have a group of Mayo-trained surgeons on my staff,
no,
but
no.
All of my sergeants, as you know, go through an annual training to provide that immediate initial response. We also have oxygen units in place in various spots around the Capitol for quick access. We also have defibrillators that are accessible for that instantaneous response,
okay.
Hopefully for those critical first moments when an incident occurs.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I've seen the defibs. Seen the defibs. I just often wondered if anybody either knew how to use them or knew where they were, but that assures me. Thank you.
Sir.
Great, thank you. Senator Jensen.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question in regards to, I know being on the school board, we require the schools to do drills. Will this committee that we're putting together have anything to do with putting together those types of situations that we should be having at the Capitol? Drills and...
Senator Benson.
If I may, Mr. Chair and Senator Jensen, that's one of the things that I keep raising at these meetings, how our staff needs to be trained in fire drills and tornado drills, and our staff, the sergeants and Capitol Security do such a great job. It will not be the job of the legislators to make sure they're doing that. They already know it needs to be done. They need resources, and frankly, they need senators and representatives to say to our staff and take the time ourselves that when they hold a training, we go and we respect the efforts that they make to do that. We kind of become islands unto ourselves and our calendars get full, and so it is my hope that that will become part of our culture, awareness for the purposes of security, and an understanding of training that needs to be done. And kudos to the chair for situational awareness and noticing a bag. We can also do things like if we see somebody who's wandering around, maybe looking lost, approach them, offer to help them. This needs to be a welcoming place, but it also makes it very clear that we're paying attention to what's going on around us. And so I have faith that our staff will do training. You're right, in employment situations, I had fire drills twice a year in a skyscraper in Minneapolis. And so it's not lost. They know they need to do it.
Okay.
I just don't have the time and resources.
Okay.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In regards, Senator Senjum, on the House side anyway, we have a few nurses as legislators that come in handy now and then. And we did have an incident of one of our fellow legislators having a very late night session. And I can testify that with the able support of staff and a few of us around, that quickly assistance was gotten, but it doesn't hurt to have Regent Hospital next door either and its proximity to us in addition to the AEDs and other things. But as we've all experienced with students who go through these sorts of things, everybody should have a working knowledge because it's the person who is first there in those first few seconds that make all the difference in just about any emergency situation. Even in the 35W bridge collapse, it was the private citizens who jumped into the water and held people's heads up and did things at that time until the others, all the other resources could come. So I think it's different levels. I think there's the first level, those who are immediately there. We should all have a working knowledge just in case, and then have ready access to our other trained professionals, and then that third level. And that's fairly common. But if you don't have a facility and have the opportunity for training that is institutionalized as a normal part of it, it's not any one of those weaknesses on that level. If you're only going to be dependent upon that ambulance coming, somebody could lose precious brain cells while you're waiting for that, and you really don't want to have that happen. So, but it's that 1, 2, 3 level, and I think what we're addressing here are very common and ordinary types of things that are done in any other major building, and there's no reason why we should be exempted from what is customary in any other business.
Thank you. Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Benson, anything further?
Mr. Chair, I have nothing further. Thank you.
All right. Anything further, members? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 344? All right. Members. Who would like to move Senate File 344? And it needs to be recommended to pass and referred to the State and Local Government Committee.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate File help me.
344.
What's the number?
344.
344 be recommended to pass and referred to state and local government.
All right.
Local government, sorry, local government.
Yes. All right, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Motion passes. Thank you, Senator Benson. All right, Senator Carlson, thank you for your patience. Senator Carlson has Senate File 185, Transportation Ombudsperson.
Mr. Chair, as he approaches the chair, do you know what the emergency telephone number is at the Capitol? Because I don't.
I say, Ted, please call Capitol Security. There's a bag under the stairs. Make them take it away.
Put it in your cell phone.
Call Siri.
Oh, Michael tells me we have stickers with Capitol Security emergency number we can put on our phones, so we should all get those.
I know the IT number, Mr. Chair.
The help number, the help desk number. I don't even know that. I also say, Ted. My inbox isn't working. Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Senate File 185. And, Mr. Chair and members of the Transportation Committee, Senate File 185 is a simple bill to essentially do something that's already in place. It's to formalize an existing position at the Department of Transportation. The position established is a transportation ombudsperson, amending statutes 2012, section 17402. Minnesota is the only transportation agency in the nation to have an ombudsperson position. Additionally, many other agencies in Minnesota have already had the ombudsperson or ombudsman positions. I'm going to say ombudsman because I can't say ombudsperson. Including the Department of Agriculture, Department of Human Services, Pollution Control Agency, and they've all have the ombudsperson or ombudsman position, as well as more recently air quality assistance and ombudsman for crime victims. In 2008, the department created the function to increase trust and confidence in the agency. As we all know, with our contacts with constituents, an understanding ear and an explanation are the most effective communications to bring expectations balanced with the responsibilities of any department. The ombudsperson is a neutral, independent resource for the public to connect with when they have an issue relating to MnDOT. The ombudsperson conducts neutral fact-finding, facilitates discussion, generates options, and investigates possible resolutions to the issue. The commissioner then makes the final decision on resolving the issue. To date, the ombudsperson has handled over 500 cases, with the most common case issues related to safety, right-of-way, damage to property, signage, planning, and design issues. Some examples of cases handled involved a modification to a policy concerning nighttime construction noise, also with with right-of-way and with damage claims. The ombudsperson also developed a conflict scoping process, which will help MnDOT project engineers to better predict, identify, and manage the conflicts on MnDOT projects. You have in your packet three examples or three publications. The first is a pamphlet that is used by the Office of the Ombudsperson, which shows on the back of it the at that time, three staffers, and now there are actually four people working on that in that position. There's an article from the Star Tribune, which is very complimentary to the staff ombudsperson. And then you have the annual report, which goes through the things that the ombudsperson's office has done, ombudsman's office has done, between January 2011 and December 2011. One you do not have is something that looks like this. This is actually a small flyer that I use when I have town hall meetings. It's a nonpartisan town hall meeting announcement, plus it has all the names to connect. And if we
had this for inside the Capitol, we would have that emergency number on there. And I would love to have the ombudsperson's number on here also. It does have places like road conditions, tourism, utility complaints, and one for seniors, a senior ombudsman. At this point, it is not a budget issue because it's already in place. You have a fiscal note that shows that there's no funds required. At this point, the agency is neutral on it because there is some reluctance to mandate to the executive branch a position. But in this case, what we would like to do is we would like to be able to memorialize a person and a contact on places like our sheets here and be sure that we can count on that for the future. And I think that adding to that is the size of the budget that we do have for transportation in Minnesota, that a person like this is a very valuable resource to be able to call. With that, Mr. Chair, I will answer any questions that anyone might have.
Well, thank you, Senator Carlson. Questions, members? Senator Reiner.
Thank you, Chair Dole. Senator Carlson, can you just talk a little bit about the rationale behind wanting to put it into legislation? You know, it sounds like an important position and a valuable one, but, you know, I always get a little bit nervous when we put all those requirements there and then at some point priorities change and we either need to go back and change legislation versus just giving the department the flexibility to say we don't really need that anymore. But, and I'm sure you've got it, so.
Yep. Well, we have it. With primarily,
Senator Carlson.
Sorry, Mr. Chair and Senator Reiner. Primarily, we are doing this because we want to make sure that it is a continuing position. Something like this was put into being by Commissioner Sorrell, and Commissioner Zelli is also going to support it. But if we would, we have this now, we have a number now, we have a person now, we have a person for us to contact. And if this was something that might be left up to a new commissioner or a change in administration, it would go away.
Right.
And I think that it's important for us to make sure that it is available to us in the future. And if you, I don't have the distribution like this, but we do have in statute the small business air quality compliance. That's in 116.98. We have Office of Ombudsman for qualifications and function. That's in 245.92. We have one for long-term care, that's 256.974. And another one is for the for people enrolling in health plans, and that's 256B.69. So there's, one more that's in 611A. That's a criminal victim's advice. So they are valuable enough in other agencies to put into statute, and I think that it is, it's, you know, marginal, but it is somewhat logical to have something like that so that it's guaranteed for the long term.
All right. Thank you. And for Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, one of the things that was brought to my attention was the cost associated with this department. It appears that it's gone up, and we didn't really have this in our packet, but I think nonpartisan staff could confirm this, but it's gone up from $112,000 in 2008 to up to $500,000 now proposed for 2013. Can you give us an indication of why it's gone up so fast in cost or expenses?
Senator Carlson, if you know. Otherwise, we do have the agency here who can maybe help us out as well.
I could probably ask the agency, but I think my first response would be that one person is the initial cost, and it has been a popular call to make. And it has expanded up to four people now. Even on your flyer, you'll see that there were three people named on there, and it's now gone up to four. And this has been just a matter of demand. The only position that we're putting into this legislation is the lead person. not the staff people.
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, so you think as a department, or maybe I should ask them to come up, the demand what's referencing that we've had increased problems with community members working with our agency, and it would seem appropriate that if we have these increased problems that maybe we ought to make changes in the agency rather than just continuing to add, you know, to the expense of this office. Is that a reasonable request? Or
Senator Peterson, maybe people have always had problems with the agency and now those problems are getting resolved. I don't
maybe.
Know. One perspective. I'll allow Senator Carlson or Mr. Peterson respond.
Yes, I would like to hear Mr. Peterson's response on that also.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Scott Peterson from MnDOT. And Senator Peterson, I would say the increase in staff is really due to the increased awareness of the availability of the service to people in the state that MnDOT encounters. I would say that it's, in my view anyway, it's not really related to an increase in the number of conflicts that we have with folks, but rather the recognition at the Ombudsman's office is a good place to go to try to get a fair resolution when we do have conflict.
Yeah, Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, I don't think I disagree with that. To that point, I do think it'd probably be more appropriate for the legislature to make a direct appropriation for this office rather than just making an appropriation to the agency and then to have the agency spend it, you know, how they see fit. So I have the A3 amendment. Essentially, members, what this amendment would do would be specifically appropriate a dollar amount in law from the legislature rather than having the agency continue to expand this office and work. So what it would do, it would ask the agency to come back and ask us as legislators, the elected officials, for a specific dollar amount and then let us approve that dollar amount through an appropriation each time.
So Senator Peterson has the A3 amendments.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry if Senator Carlson mentioned this already, but who hires the current ombudsman for the Department of Transportation?
Senator Carlson or Senator Peterson, who hires the current ombudsman person?
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I would suspect that that is the commissioner's responsibility. This person does report to the commissioner.
Because Senator Thomas Chairman and Senator Carlson, I think one of the most important parts about this is that the ombudsman is supposed to be neutral. And my experience with one of the ombudsmen was they were sort of taking the department side. And I'm just kind of wondering if doing this in law like this would make him even more beholden to the commissioner, because now it's an appointment right in law. I don't know which one is worse, but if we're supposed to be neutral and actually facilitate information being given out to the local communities, if we make this a in-law appointment by the commissioner, I'm wondering if it's kind of becomes an assistant commissioner type position and then suddenly is beholden to the commissioner, and then the actual job of the ombudsman maybe becomes a little less neutral than it probably should be. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Tomasoni, I guess I would probably take the opposite view in that once it is let's be truthful, we're putting a mandate on the agency to have a person in that position. So it's no longer up to the commissioner to either have or not have that person. So I would suspect that we're actually taking away a little bit of that independence in putting it onto the legislature's mandate. So the commissioner would not be free to just move that person aside and out of position. They would have to have someone would have some sort of neutrality. I guess that's the way I would look at that.
I'm not sure how to go on this just because of the fact that it sounds like the commissioner hires the ombudsman now, and or the ombudsperson now. And so now we're just putting it in statute. So I'm not sure what the difference is and how it would either be better or worse.
Maybe Mr. Peterson can, we're really kind of a little bit afield from the A3. Maybe we can deal with the A3 first and then get back to this question of neutrality. Senator Carlson, to the A3.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I guess I would oppose the A3 in that it, I think it's really a, to some degree, a micromanaging a position that that should be, that the salary and the expenses should be overseen by the department. I think that's something that that they will have the most control over, and also they should be accountable for that. It shouldn't be something that the legislature micromanages. So I would oppose the A3 amendment.
Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I would ask you to consider supporting it because I think you realize so many times elected officials are held responsible for decisions that state agencies make. And we have very little control over that, particularly through the rulemaking process and an example like this through this office. And so one way as legislators, to Senator Tomasoni's point, if he has an ombudsman that appears to be non-neutral, one way the legislature responds is to not fund that department at the same level until they can demonstrate that they can be neutral. And so it is absolutely appropriate, in my view, for the legislature to look at this appropriation because legislators are so often held responsible for the actions of state agencies. And this is one of the few ways, members, that you can control that as a legislature, and I would urge your support of the A3 amendment.
Anything further, members? Senator Peterson, I just confess I need to think about the A3 myself. We do specify certain positions at MnDOT, but we don't specifically appropriate for those. We have a number of positions that we specify at MnDOT. So we'd be treating this position a little bit differently. That being said, I don't know that I'm. I find this language difficult for me to accept. I just, frankly, Senator Peterson, I would have appreciated an opportunity to consider this idea previously. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll just say that, and I agree with your position, Mr. Chair. I'm not quite sure how to vote on this amendment either, but the reason I'm going to support it is because this is a neutral position. So we're getting at the point that Senator Tomasoni mentioned. Senator Peterson just mentioned, if we don't feel that this position, the people in this position are being neutral, as a legislature, as members, we really can't do anything about it. But if this amendment were to pass, we'd have a say in it. We could talk about their funding or bring them into committee and ask some questions specifically about the funding. So for that reason, I'm going to support the amendment.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Champion first, and then Senator Thomason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two issues. One is I would first say that we should oppose the amendment, and here's why I think we should oppose the amendment. The language on 1.4 specifically says it may not transfer from any other appropriation, which seems to restrict the ability for the commissioner to find ways to fund this position in the event that there is no direct appropriation. If we believe that this is an important function, then it is something that we want to provide the flexibility for the commissioner to think through how to achieve that desired outcome, which is to have this position available and to fund it appropriately. The second issue that I have that I'm having a little anxiety over, and perhaps Senator Carlson can help me, is not necessarily just specifically to the amendment, but is around why we're doing this in the first place. So perhaps that'll help me, that'll help drive what I'm going to do, because it looks like I'm going to oppose the amendment. But I really want to understand why we're doing this, if it's working, if there's no problem. It's my understanding this has been going on since 2006 or something like that. So if the senator would be so kind as to just enlighten me as to why this is important to do at this time.
Thanks, Senator Champion. And I'll just say, I think Senator Carlson has articulated that he wants this ombudsperson to survive beyond the present commissioner. I mean, I think that's the short version of the answer, but Senator Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's true. Backing up just a little bit on the amendment, that this would have to be a line item in the budget for MnDOT. So it would precede the spending of it by quite some time. So it would have to be for the legislature to decide whether this is viable or not would require information that would tell them that they no longer can fund this. You know, I mean, we're really, like I say, we're micromanaging what they're doing. And I think what we've already seen by the annual report and by the information and by the article involved in it is that this is a very, very good thing. Now I'm going to back up just a little bit on and this is not to the A3 amendment, but it is a little bit more of the sales pitch on this. Prior to August of 2007, a young woman came to me and said, my car got hit by a piece of concrete falling off of the France Avenue Bridge. It hit the cowling right below my windshield. And who do I call? And I said, oh, call MnDOT. Of course, MnDOT is... I'm not sure what number she called, and she got a person, and she talked to that person, and they actually did send someone out to the bridge and look at it, and they couldn't find a place where this concrete had been dislodged. But they said, because we couldn't prove that it had come off of our bridge, we're not going to pay for your damage on your car. And she said, well, I'm really upset about that, and... are our bridges falling apart? And he said to her that it's not the small ones we're worried about, it's the big ones. And this was the Wednesday prior to the collapse of the 35W bridge. And I was trying to find that article that was published in the local papers about this later on in that summer. But this is the kind of thing that I think we have people calling and asking about bridges, calling and asking about damage, calling and asking about signs, about right of way, about when the construction vehicles come too close to their homes and do damage. And I think we need someone like this to be able to answer those kinds of questions and to perhaps come up with at least the face of the agency so that they can, resolve some of those disputes. And most often, again, it's just a sympathetic ear. But again, back on the A3 amendment, I think that there's difficulty there in the legislature deciding how much the agency should put into this or should not put into this. And I think all we want is a place to call, is an ombudsman to call. And that's a consistent number and a consistent person. And whether they staff it with 1, 5, 10, 12, that's up to the agency to determine.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I could ask a question of our nonpartisan staff, my understanding is that MnDOT uses this, or we use this type of direct appropriation specifically with the Department of Aeronautics, which really, in my view, for members of the Senate here, I think it's about transparency and giving the legislature a chance to fund this if it's working and to not fund it, quite frankly, members, if it's not working. Is that an accurate statement in terms of the Office of Aeronautics? Do we have a direct appropriation?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, that's true that we do direct appropriations per program and per budget activity to the department. So the Office of Aeronautics would get a direct appropriation, the Office of Rail, et cetera.
So, Mr. Chair, members, this is not an unusual amendment, unusual request in terms of a direct direct appropriation. I would encourage you to support the amendment.
All right. Anything further, yeah. Senator Carlson? Oh, sorry, Senator Kent, and then Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Carlson, going back to the original discussion about how this position and that. And it, the team has evolved over time, and then it started out with one, and now we're up to four people. And perhaps Mr. Peterson can help address some of the history of this. This has been responsive on the part of the department to the need and the requests to citizens and their questions. Is that correct?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kent, yes, that's correct. Yep.
So my concern with this amendment is that we lose that flexibility, that if we start legislating a team of three people and the department finds that to truly be responsive to the citizens, we need two more, we've tied their hands in that way. So I would just add that to the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, I think the other part of this office that should be surprising is that in that same time frame from 2008 to 2013 the expenses for those folks, those three people, have gone from one to three. For travel, employee development, and professional contract spending, it's gone from $1,000 the first year to $110,000. And that's because the legislature does not get to talk about this appropriation, in my view.
Thank you. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my question is more to the overall bill, so I can wait until after we vote on the amendment if we want.
Okay.
If we're going to continue to.
All right. Thanks. I'll come back to you. Senator Kent.
Mr. Peterson, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I don't know if this is information that you would have off the top of your head, but I guess I'm wondering if these are questions and issues that have been fielded by the department for the year over the years, but by having the ombudsman position in place, then you have resources that are dedicated towards addressing these kinds of concerns and issues, and that perhaps some of the resources are being removed out of other areas when calls were just coming in and received who knows where. Would that be, do you know if that's been the case?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kent, well, I can say that a lot of the issues that come up had previously been dealt with by, like, project managers and people who those people report to if they can't be resolved by the project manager. And I'd also say that before the Ombudsman's Office was created, we got a lot of those calls in government affairs when constituents express their concern to their local legislator, and then they would come to us to try to find a way for them to get resolution. So I do think it's true that by having the Ombudsman service available to the public to resolve differences of opinion, that it's lightened the workload on other folks as well.
And
Senator Kent.
Mr. Chair, with one more follow-up, and I guess I come at this from a private sector background where customer service is a normal part of the way organizations operate, and we have it just seems like that MnDOT has the flexibility to allocate the resources to take care of these issues and potentially handled more effectively and efficiently by people who are dedicated to those kinds of questions as opposed to government affairs people, not that you wouldn't be perfectly capable of handling it. So, thank you.
Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Peterson, your last argument convinced me to vote against the bill, your amendment. And the only reason is because if we've gone from 1,000 to 100,000 in expenses on the ombudsman, then maybe we need him really badly. And that this might actually do exactly the opposite of allowing them to be out there when they need to be out there. But maybe Mr. Peterson can give Senator Peterson a... Is it spelled the same?
Nope.
No. Okay. A reason why the costs went up, or explain why the office has incurred more expenses, and maybe answer the question that is also in the bill here that says the transportation ombudsperson may not hold another formal position within the department. Is that how it works now? Are they holding another position within the department?
Mr. Peterson. Are we spending more because things are getting worse or better at MnDOT?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I think the reason that probably there's a requirement in the bill to not have the person hold another position is, again, to try and ensure that independence that was discussed earlier. The current director of that office, you know, that is her job. She doesn't, you know, she doesn't have any other title or responsibility. And, you know, going back to earlier conversation too, she and her staff have the appropriate skills to, you know, work with people who have a difference of opinion, sometimes very strong differences of opinion, in ways that the rest of us really aren't really well equipped to do that same type of work. And part of the reason they have those skills is I think somewhat the answer to the other question about how the spending has increased for non-salary expenses, and that as this role has matured, they've taken training and they've developed materials to distribute through the department about how to work through some of these more frequent areas of conflict that come up. Some of the more common ones have already been mentioned here, so there's no need to go back to it, but I think it's really now, in a way, started to permeate out beyond the office in terms of, well, these are strategies and approaches one should take when you get into a situation where you have a strong difference of opinion with a member of the public or somebody who's affected by one of our projects. One of the other reasons for the increase in spending is that we hired an internal ombudsman so that employees who have a particular employment-related issue with the department, they didn't feel they were getting maybe the appropriate treatment or proper consideration of their concern through the regular organizational channels, have another option for expressing their concern or complaint and getting that considered fairly as well. And then the other, I think, thing that's related to the increase in spending is that the Ombudsman's Office has been working on a concept for, I think it's called the Center of Excellence for Conflict Resolution. So in order to more fully develop the capacity to provide training and develop skills in more people at the department to do a better job of kind of short-circuiting some of these disagreements before they get too blown out of proportion or too hard to manage.
Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, this ombudsman position, I think the Department of Revenue has one. How does this run differently than that, or is it funded differently? Because that one, from my experience, is quite separate from the commissioner's office. Is this quite identical, or do you know on that?
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Westrom, that's a question I can't answer. I don't see a listing of that particular ombudsman in the statute, so I don't know if that one is funded separately, funded from another agency, or where it's located, if it's located in statute. That
Senator Carlson, what about the other agencies? There were a couple, I think, that you mentioned.
I see that in the Mr. Chair, in the write-up of them, it does, the commissioner shall appoint is the word that's used in a couple of them. And so I'm assuming that this one in it's proposed for MnDOT is similar to that. In 256B.69, it says the commissioner shall designate under 611A74, this is the crime victim of ombudsman. The commissioner shall have the authority to investigate decisions, acts, and other matters. And so they're said in different ways. And I guess I don't have an answer to you just how that other revenue would run theirs. Which brings up, Mr. Chair, if I may ask a question of Ms. Boyd, when she mentioned the aviation department and one other department, are those ombudsman positions you're speaking of, or are they specific positions that are being funded that way? And maybe that can help answer Senator Westrom's question.
Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair and Senator Carlson, no, I was speaking about total appropriation for operations of those budget activities within the MnDOT budget bill. So there are no positions designated in those line item appropriations. Right.
Members, I'll just mention that Senator Peterson's amendment does say the ombudsperson program must be specifically appropriated. Senator Westrom.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to support this amendment, but I think I heard to Senator Tomasoni and Senator Miller and other concerns. Maybe subsequent information about the Department of Revenue and their ombudsperson, because my recollection and visiting of with former or employees of the Department of Revenue, but also using that ombudsperson for some constituents, it's very separated, as I understand, which it always gets to be a tension if the own agency is appointing and holding the purse strings for that office. You can call it as independent as you want, but it's still he who pays the fiddler calls the tune, as the old saying goes. And so I'm just thinking whether this goes on or off, it still might be valuable insight if we could have staff or somebody give us that information, because the Department of Revenue it just sticks in my mind that when I've used them in the past and the information that was given, it's a very separate office, so you feel like you get an independent advocate for your concerns that will go to work to try to figure out how to.
I'll give Senator Carlson that assignment. I have Senator Kiffmeyer, then Peterson, then Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just, in regards to this and listening to it, excellent discussion, Mr. Chairman. But when I see the rapid growth and the size of it, you do have a large agency, but also see this rapid growth. The biggest thing I would think is that a commissioner might be concerned that we appropriate funds to the Department of Transportation for some very specific purposes. So my concern would be protecting those purposes and those funds that we, the legislature, have done, and that you can have a mission creep or scope, and sometimes this is kind of a handy place to go if you don't know what else to do, have them do it. And so it's a protective nature to our rest of our transportation and the other purposes. And I think that's important, and I think by a direct line appropriation, we help to protect and limit that. The other thing is that you really want to have the customer service point of this, which a lot of this is, happening on the closest level, and that you want to empower, like what you talked about, that others within the Department of Transportation can resolve these without having to go up to an ombudsman. You really would like to not have to go there, that this could be taken care of on a direct level with a direct level employee, instead of moving it on up with this kind of a thing. I think the one thing in supporting the A3 amendment that I have is that this enables us to keep an eye on it, help manage it, and make sure that we protect the proper uses of the transportation funding. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Kiffmeyer. Senator Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To that point, Ms. Boyd, without a direct appropriation, could the commissioner, say, for example, take money to fund this department, say, from the trunk highway funds?
Ms. Boyd?
Mr. Chair and Senator Peterson, the bulk of MnDOT's operating budget is from the trunk highway fund. The department does, usually in the biennial budget bill, they do have blanket appropriation to move funds around. Unencumbered balances in the trunk highway fund that have been appropriated to them. The only limit on that is that nothing can be taken from the appropriation for state road construction.
Senator Peterson.
So I think the answer is yes, right? Yeah, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that answer, because I am sorry to see, is Senator Tomasoni still here? And Senator Jensen, I would hope that, we very likely could see, you will see, potentially, trunk money that should be going to roads and our trunk highway funds going to fund this office. With a direct appropriation and your support of this amendment, you will keep that from happening. And our trunk highway funds will go to roads.
Thank you. Senator Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for the MnDOT representative. I just want to confirm that I heard you correctly. Did you say that MnDOT has hired an ombudsman internally to handle internal employee relations? Is that correct?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, it's a consultant contract for a person, to help mediate disputes between employees and the organization or their supervisor. Some other source of disappointment or displeasure with what's going on in the department. It's kind of a safe avenue for them to express their concerns without fear of retribution, I think, is the notion behind it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just Senator a follow-up to the representative. So that person really has nothing to do with customer service for our constituents or Minnesotans. That just strictly internal MnDOT employees.
Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, that's correct.
Okay, and one more follow-up, Mr. Chairman. Is that Miller. A full-time equivalent?
Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Miller, no, it's a external contract person that we have on kind of an as-needed basis, and I don't know how many hours she works a week or a month or
okay. something. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a comment. It looks like to me this amendment I would have some problems with because the department, MnDOT, is the one who actually started the omnibus. Why is it named that? that they set up that person because they were wanting to develop trust within the Department of Transportation. And what we're getting is an offshoot of it because it's growing so much. Obviously, that's pointing to the legislators that there might be a problem of some sort in that area. But what this bill says is, do we trust that the department is going to continue that practice of developing more trust in the department? And then this amendment is saying, well, how are we going to pay for it? If we would have set it up as legislators originally, I can understand making that appropriation. But this was it looks and appears to be an attempt by the department to try to do that rather than coming from legislators and legislation. So my problem with the amendment would be, are we going to appropriate something that has been done internally within the Department of Transportation? So I would oppose this amendment.
Thank you. Anything further on the A3? A3 is before us.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Sendrum. And members, we do have one more bill and 25 minutes left.
And I'll just be brief. I personally and a good number of people in our community have had experience with the ombudsman, and I don't know if Deb LaVita is here or not, but she's just a marvelous person. I will tell you, they still talk about her back home. Given the Highway 52 project, she was just invaluable. No question about it. So I have no problems with respect to the amendment or certainly the program. I think with that kind of service, this program will survive. I support the amendment because I think it just does give that program just a little bit more autonomy and makes it a little bit more of a friend of the legislature, and I think that's important as we move forward.
Okay, members, on the A3, all in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no?
No.
A3 passes. Thank you. All right, to Senate File 185 as amended. So, Senator Carlson, what's your pleasure? You can move your own bill. You can go right to the floor.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate File 185 to be recommended to pass and forwarded.
As amended?
As amended.
All right. Anything further, members?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni?
Maybe for Mr. Peterson, now that there's that amendment on the bill, does the department have an opinion on this now or not? Or don't you know?
Senator Peterson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, I think we're still neutral on the bill.
Okay. I failed to call for further testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on Senate File 185? All right. To Senator Carlson's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed, no. Motion passes.
Chair and committee.
All right. Senator Rest, welcome. Out of one hearing to another. It's Senator Rest Day in the State Senate today. $2.56. Vehicle lighting. Why don't you try one of the other microphones? Thanks.
It's better?
Oh, yes.
Yes, okay. So a constituent of mine approached me in 2008 and said, why don't we require people to have their lights on all the time? They have it. I think at the time they were considering it, but they passed it eventually. In the European Union, that you must drive with, I do believe it's either running, I think it's running lights there, and he said it's a safety measure. Would you do a bill on it? And I became intrigued, as many of us are, when we get an idea from a constituent to pursue that. Senator Dibble and I, in the past, have both been taken up by constituents who wanted to have permission or under the law to ride e-bikes on parks and trails, and that came from the experience of constituents rather than any big lobbying group or the department or so on. And so in 2008, I proposed a bill that did exactly what is in the language here, and it was laid over, and then in 2009, I was back. And at that point, the chair of the committee decided that it was worthwhile having the Department of Transportation do a study on it. And so that study was done and presented in 2011. And the results of it indicates that there are indeed safety benefits from having lights on 24/7. Nevertheless, in 2011, then when I proposed it again, it was once again laid over. So it's kind of like once a biennium, here I am, and so here I am in 2013, proposing once again that lights be displayed by 24/7. What has happened in the meanwhile? Well, we had the Department of Transportation's report, and then there was a concern, and I certainly can understand it, that from those who ride motorcycles. You may or may not know, I don't know how much, I hope you pay attention to them, I really do, but motorcycles by law must have lights on 24/7, regardless of what kind of configuration of those lights there are. And there was a concern that if cars started having their lights on, that would diminish something that's called the conspicuity. That means how conspicuous, but it's a term of art that NHTSA uses, the conspicuity of motorcycles. And in particular, they did a study that they released in September of 2011, looking at and asking questions and really not coming to any definitive answers about if cars had their lights on all the time, would that diminish the conspicuity of motorcycles in terms of crashes? when the department did their study, they did like a review of the literature and determined that it would increase the safety on Minnesota roadways. The conspicuity was tested, which was really interesting. Most of the time, apparently, when motorcycles are in crashes, it occurs when a car approaching them turns in front of them, and so it's a left turn. It's a left turn issue, and so by having their lights on all the time, how visible are they to an oncoming car? And they did a study. NHTSA did a study with raising some of those questions and issues with also using some Canadian data. And they did find that they tended to allow more room for some drivers. I think the Canadian ones allowed more room for motorcycles than did American ones. And so then the question becomes, is it a matter of location, regionality, how much ambient light there is during the daytime? And, of course, we are all assumed that cars have their lights on at night. And, of course, the law currently says if you're using your windshield wipers, that's an indication that your lights must go on. We also know that more and more automobile manufacturers have a automatic lights on technology inside the newer cars. The rest of us have to, in a sense, program. Although I drive, let's see, how old is it now? A 12-year-old car. And that feature was in the 2001 Volvos too. So my lights are on all the time, even yet now. But it is we can wait until all the old cars are off the roads for the cars and the fleets to have lights on 24/7, or we can be proactive. Taking into concern the motorcyclists' issues, but that we can move forward in a proactive way and consider having lights on 24/7 in the name of safety.
Thank you, Senator. I'll just mention, you might have mentioned it in case you didn't, though. NHTSA members is the National Highway Traffic right. Safety Administration.
And they have all kinds of reports, if you have a mind to read them, and all kinds of statistics, and they're testing things constantly to make recommendations on what brings about the safest behaviors, and MnDOT does some of that as well. And certainly that was the study, and this is a study that they did, that they released in January 2011, that indicated, and if you, I think you have some of the pages of that it did have a positive effect and benefit for safety. What remains problematic is that it is some of the findings, both with the motorcycles and with the cars, they're not overly dramatic. They're not the kind of finding, it's a kind of a marginal increase in safety, 3 or 4%, as opposed to what we know to be the impact of wearing seatbelts, for example. But I think we're at the point of where we're looking at safety provisions on the margin, and that when we can do something as simple as keep our lights on 24/7 and have that impact, I think it's worthwhile of the committee's consideration.
Thank you, Senator Rest. Senator Osmick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Rest, is it fair to assume that this legislation would make having your lights off a primary offense so that officers would be pulling them over for this offense as a primary offense?
Senator Ress.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Osment, I think the way the bill is stated, it's that way, but I don't think that should be the standard. I think it should not be a primary offense. But I have a question for counsel along that same regard. There are a lot of cars that drive with their lights off when it's raining. Is that a primary offense or a secondary offense? Same along that line.
Ms. Berezovsky.
Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, it's a primary offense.
And
Senator Rest.
And one of the criticisms, Senator Osment, has been, so we already have a primary offense about driving with your lights on when it's raining, and when you get out there, you can see maybe, 25% of the cars don't have that, and you don't see any of them being pulled over. So why would you have, the question becomes for the committee, and I mean this seriously, becomes, so why would you have another, even a secondary offense, with a in a law that nobody bothers to enforce and 25% of the people don't follow? And, you know, that's just a question we have to wrestle with. We know, however, that when we made it's not just a matter of making something a primary offense. You have to enforce it. And the lights on with the windshield wipers, it is just simply not enforced. And you can say, well, we don't want police officers stopping people because they don't have their lights on when it is raining. But we really don't know the degree to which that if we did have an aggressive enforcement program, the degree to which we would have fewer and fewer crashes during inclement weather. But I certainly, I think I'm more interested in a real education program on this, and I would not insist that this particular provision, if the committee eventually acts favorably on it, be a primary offense.
Senator Osment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, actually, I don't really agree much with the lights on with the windshield wipers either, exactly for those reasons. It's not enforced,
right,
and
I
don't think it really makes that much of a difference. But to the bill itself, how would you – I have a number of constituents that have collector cars. I have a number of constituents that have older cars prior to 2000 who don't have the automatic on system. My vehicles in the last 3 years certainly have had a matter of fact, I drove out of Orlando Airport and thought I had automatic on, and I didn't. So I had some police that were suddenly telling me, you should turn your lights on. How do you reconcile that with really you almost have a discriminatory situation with people with newer cars automatically are never going to have a problem with this event or this offense. Meanwhile, the people that are cars that are 2000 or older are really going to be discriminated against.
Senator Rest.
So,
it's raining in here.
So, Mr. Chairman and Senator Osment, so did you deliberately choose a year that was 1 year older than my car?
Senator Rest, I just took your year to start with.
I know, I just subtracted one. I think that is a very valid point, but I do, again, think that we certainly exceptions could be made by the type of vehicle, and just because you might exempt 2% of the cars or 1% of the cars doesn't mean you wouldn't want the provision applied to 98% of the cars. So just, members, I appreciate your indulgence. I think this is a safety issue. It remains extremely important to my constituent, and I'm happy to be here in his stead and on his behalf.
Thank you. Anything further, members? Senator Wieger. Senator Wieger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, is it your intent to have an omnibus bill on policy addressing safety, or would this, if it passed, go on its own?
Senator Wieger, it is my intent to have an omnibus transportation policy bill, yes. If this bill goes on its own, that doesn't mean this bill can't be included in that. I guess it would be the pleasure of the author, if she would like to suspend the bill here and include it later, or move it on a bullet track.
I would much rather it be part of the menu of your omnibus bill.
Okay.
If you think it's an idea that, modify it, could go forward in some fashion. Although I don't think we need to study it again.
Okay. No, it's time to
45-page report.
Fish or cut bait, as it were. Senator Wieger?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, maybe it was mentioned, would this be a petty misdemeanor?
Senator Wieger, I did ask Senate counsel, yes, it would be petty, so it would not, in that case, go to the Judiciary Committee. It could just move on.
Thank you.
Who first? Senator Peterson, then Senator Kiffmeyer.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I do have an amendment, the A1 amendment I'd like to offer that accomplishes what you just mentioned there. It would basically make this a secondary offense so that a police officer would not pull over a driver for not having the lights. They would deal with that if they were pulled over for some other reason. It does not address the reining issue, but I could do that as an oral amendment if you're acceptable to that.
Mr. Chairman and
Senator Rest.
Senator Peterson, I have no objection to your amendment. I would, however, have appreciated being apprised of it before it's just handed to me. Now, it's not particularly good practice to do that.
No,
but
that right.
being said, I would support it. And I think before, however, you would add the driving in the rain, that you would consider that a separate discussion and get more input from the Department of Public Safety and the Department of Transportation. But this is my bill, and so I'm happy to accept it.
Yeah, Mr. Chair.
Senator Peterson.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, I do apologize. Your point is well taken. I should have gotten to you ahead of time with it. But members, this amendment, as you'll see, does exactly what we discussed. It would make it a secondary offense, so a police officer could not pull over somebody for driving without their lights on, and I would encourage you to support it along with Senator Rest's encouragement as well.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Tomasoni.
Before I get to the amendment, would counsel tell me if all day running lights count as being lights on during these periods of time?
Mr. Chair, Senator Tomasoni, I believe that the running lights would work in daylight. And
yep. So they count as having your lights on?
That would be a
even when it's raining?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Tomasoni, that's what the rule is in Europe, too.
But even when it's raining, all day running lights, because they're not headlights. They're yellow lights.
Mr. Chairman, I'm getting beyond my level of understanding and knowledge here, but I think the thing with the rain is you have to have your headlights on. Running lights are not good enough.
Ms. Barrett, we're
trying to have cars seen here in this particular instance.
As to
Senator Tomasoni, or maybe someone in the audience, troll or public safety can help us distinguish or differentiate running lights, daylights,
headlights.
Rain.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Jared Jordahl with the Department of Public Safety. Forgive me, I'm getting over a cold as well. I heard some of the questions. I think our read of the bill was that it would require headlamps rather than daytime running lamps. I think that was one of the questions. I don't recall the others.
Okay. Senator Thompson.
And Mr. Chairman, 2 points. Then to Senator Osmek's point of the new cars having the automatic lights, they have automatic all-day running lights. They don't have automatic headlights coming on unless it gets dark enough for the automatic headlights to come on. And the second thing is I'm opposing Senator Peterson's amendment because we did the same thing with seatbelts and said it would be a secondary offense, and it suddenly became a primary offense. So I don't want this bill to pass in any way, shape, or form.
Mr. Chair, to Senator Tomasoni's point, I have a 2011 Silverado. They have on the headlamps are on. Anytime I turn the ignition on, I have to physically command it to turn off the headlamps. So I think we're going to find some have them on, some have them off. Some foreign ones may have them off, on. Who knows? We were just having a side discussion, but I would point to this section of the bill on line 1.14. It specifically indicates lighted headlamps, so that means the lighted white lights that you need to drive in the night have to be on.
To that point, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Thompson.
At the end of that line, what do illuminating devices mean?
I know what a headlamp is. I don't know what that one is.
Illuminating devices could easily be all day running lights, correct or no?
Senator Ress.
Certainly, mostly concerned that a car is seen by others rather than this is not the way in which you go down the street, which, you know, I think the public safety would say that's you try and see as well as be seen when you have your headlights on in the rain. And I'm looking for it's a different goal than that. And, you know,
you're right.
I'm willing to work on crafting something that maybe wouldn't get Senator Tomassoni's
support,
but, you know, we're friends. the running lights, which I believe is what the European standard is.
Okay, members, we have just a couple of minutes left. What I hope we do is deal with the amendment, perhaps. We're going to lay the bill on the table for more work. And pick it up again at some point in the near future, if not at the next meeting. Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to tell you why I would support Senator Peterson's amendment. I have a car that you have to open the headlights and then turn them on. And when you open the headlights, the car gets ugly. So I would probably support this amendment because then I can drive my car without worrying about getting pulled over as a primary. But also on the, it does say lighted tail lamps, and some daytime running lights do not light the tail lamps. So in some models of cars and ages, the tail lights do not go on unless you put on the headlights.
What do you mean the car gets ugly?
Pardon me?
What do you mean by the car gets ugly?
Well, your headlights are open and it looks like a bird.
Oh, I see. So it's aesthetically displeasing.
That's a Corvette.
All right. So why don't we do this? Members, to the A1 amendment, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no?
No.
No.
Motion passes.
Vision.
All right. All in favor, please raise your hand.
What?
The amendment. You voted no.
Yeah. The bill.
All right. All opposed, raise your hand. There being 9 in voting aye, 4 voting no, the amendment passes. Chair will lay Senate File 256 as amendment on the table for possible inclusion in our omnibus transportation policy bill. Thank you, members. Anything further, members? We're back on Wednesday, more bills, and we are adjourned.